Jackalope Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Dean Hagler from the Office of Irrational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core in the middle of the Arctic wonder that is to Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpack Hollywood, and I am here, as always, with
our Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Your and our host, Mr. Interrupter himself, Phil Arnaz.
The Interrupter.
I am the designer. You're the Interrupter.
Dean Hagler.
Hello, Phil Arnaz.
So exciting to be here.
Again.
On Monday, October 17th.
Is that what it is?
Coming to people through the magic of podcasting.
Yes.
Because not only are we coming to them together here in the Eastern Columbia,
yeah,
at the same time.
How is that possible?
You are, I believe, in Sydney, Australia, perhaps?
It could be Melbourne, Australia.
Already. Yeah. Already, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I'm Sydney, liquored up in a hotel room high atop downtown Salem, Oregon.
Look at you go. That's how you have a film festival.
Because you are going to Armageddon Con.
Armageddon Con.
In Melbourne, Australia, where you were being reunited with Tom and Bruce, the Lone Gunman, together again.
And we're doing hilarious Lone Gunman improv comedy, the three of us.
The wait is over. And meanwhile, I am showing The Truth Is Out There.
Our documentary.
At Salem Film Festival.
How exciting is the Salem Film Festival?
Showed it yesterday, yes. Sunday, the 16th.
How'd it go?
It was fantastic.
Fantastic.
And I'm actually not liquored up. Of course, I'm putting on my suit and tie and getting ready to head over to the Salem Cinema for our second screening of the film this evening.
And then get liquored up.
No, and then I, after spending a fun day in Portland and Lake Oswego, I'll be heading down to Northern California.
Wow.
And showing The Truth Is Out There. While you are at Armageddon Con, I will be showing The Truth Is Out There at ufoxfest.com.
Awesome.
Oh, wait. Oh, no. I'm sorry. That's UFO X Fest.
Not
Dean,
you,
I always
Fest.
Thought Dean put the fox in you, Fox.
Fest. You, Fox Fest. No, UFO X Fest.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. So that's fun. And so, of course, parts of this program pre-recorded.
What? How? Parts, why do you say that?
Parts really pre-recorded.
That's true.
Because
they go way back.
We travel a lot.
You and I travel a lot. Don't kid yourself.
And at the beginning of last month, September, Labor Day weekend.
What a weekend it was.
We were in Hotlanta.
Hot.
Atlanta, California. Oh, Lord.
Georgia.
I'm jet lagged.
Georgia.
Atlanta, at least Georgia. I got the city right.
You did. Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, Georgia.
For Dragon Con.
For Dragon Con. You know why I said California? Because I feel so at home at Dragon Con that it's almost as if I didn't travel at all.
That was the lamest save ever. Seriously.
So we were at Dragon Con,
yes.
And I, of course, brought the camera, as I do.
As you do.
Recorded many different fun things there.
Including my panels.
Two events of which I have cut together to be this very installment.
Look at you.
Of your Chilpack Hollywood
so
Hour.
So it's me talking again.
Well, for the next half hour or so, we are going to hear highlights from X-Track's panel at Dragon Con. Welcome back to Dragon Con, Dean Hagland.
So this is me now.
Being welcomed back
to
Dragon Con and talking to your fans for the next 26 minutes or so.
Let's listen. Hi. Hi, how are you? It's another year of Dragon Con. Woo-hoo! Yay. Who listens to our podcast, Chilpack Hollywood Hour? By applause.
Woo-hoo!
Three of us. Yeah. It's a hit. It's a hit podcast. Tearing up the nation. Yes. Oh, yes, you, sir.
Have you ever been to Roswell or Area 51?
Have I been to Roswell or Area 51? Funny you should ask. I was at the 65th anniversary of the crash in Roswell, where apparently there's a bit of a controversy after I went out. I took the bus tour to the crash site, and there's a farmer whose dad was there, and he puts a couple little flags on the sort of ridge, and it goes, that's where the one alien was, and here's the other one, and then this is where they locked it off, and then we all take pictures of a cliff, and then and then you all get back in a bus, and then as soon as you get back to Roswell, then all the other UFO experts go, yeah, that's not the real place. Want to get in the car? We're going to go 60 miles in the other direction where the real crash was. And then you go over to this other field. It's like, yeah, here's the alien was. Here's that one. They're there. And then you get back to Roswell, and then the other guy goes, did that idiot just drive you 60 miles in the wrong direction? That's not the crash site. The real crash site's over here. And then you're like, get another car. And so that happened for 3 days. And so I saw about 6 empty fields that all were the crash site, maybe, or not. But they say that, you know, it came in really fast and it skipped a couple times. So I think I saw every skip mark and then the final resting spot. And then...
It left an alien at each one?
It left an alien at each one, yeah. They kept falling out. They were just hanging on the side, I guess. Like a runner board from the 1920s. And they were just like bouncing off, sort of just bouncing down through the field. I can't believe it, yeah. So, but there were some people there that were like, you know, very old, and they remember seeing a piece of metal in their dad's truck and that sort of thing. So it was quite a fascinating. And then, you know, there was the parade and the fashion show, which was the, I believe it was the women that Shatner had sex with to the fashion show. That was a large fashion show. Yeah, that was pretty much it. So it was a good time. And then Area 51, of course, I got to the Little Ailey Inn, always entertained. It's the one little hotel in Rachel, Nevada that has pictures of everybody there, and it's got the tow truck with a UFO on its chain. And then we drove out to where there's a little mailbox covered in stickers that you make a right, and then you just drive for a long time over rocky roads till you get somewhere. And we didn't get that far because we were in a Mini Cooper. Not really four-wheeling it in a Mini Cooper. So after we totally tore out the transmission, we sort of turned around, got back to the highway. So I didn't see anything there either. So if you're ever in Roswell, by all means, go check it out. There's a lovely museum. The gift store is fascinating. And now with the new Stalin sent a rocket to confuse America in 1947, that was now the real crash. There's a whole new section in the gift shop just for that section. So, yeah. For those of you who missed the story, that's apparently the latest, is that it was a Stalin sent a high-speed something or other to crash in the middle of America so that we think we've been invaded. Something. Is that? Yeah, that was pretty much it. Okay. Good story. Yeah. Any other questions?
What you're referring to is in a new book by Annie Jacobs. It's entitled Area 51.
And yes.
That is, I haven't read the book, but I've read of the book.
Yeah, she's the LA Times writer, Annie Jacobs, who
exactly
interviewed
right.
75 different people from Area 51, and they're all past the stage where they signed their confidentiality agreements and now can talk about what they did at Skunk Works and at Area 51 and all that sort of thing. And yeah, that story, I believe, came out of that book.
It is definitely in the book, yes.
Yeah.
And the thing that was controversial is that she doesn't mention the source, an unnamed source.
An unnamed source.
Ridiculous story of Stalin.
Of Stalin in the 50s.
Or something.
Right, considering everything else, she's an LA Times journalist. She had carefully sourced
right.
every other thing, except here comes the Stalin story. Yeah, an unnamed source. I can't talk about it. What? Everybody else has just spilled the secrets
right.
on all sorts of stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of controversial. And that's also, I believe it's just a paragraph and a half at the end of the book.
It's a very short portion of it, yes.
Yeah, and so it's a huge, huge novel, and then at the end it's just this one thing. And, of course, that's what gets all the press.
Right.
Because everything else is all the guys saying, yeah, I was just working on this baby like a plane, or the B-2 bomber. Like, you know, none of them had really mind-blowing stories of like, oh yeah, there was these three aliens and I was hanging out with them in a bar. Like, none of that. There was no stories like that. So I believe that's probably why everybody focused on the sensational thing at the end. And somebody who knew either her or somebody knew the publisher said, oh, you gotta stick something really crazy at the end so that we have something to run with the media so that the book gets all the publicity. So
exactly right.
That may or may be how that whole thing came together. You know.
So that,
that's how it works, man. I know. It's like, remember, RJ, like how many years ago it was where you asked about Dame, who played D&D with... remember how that whole thing started? I was doing a show called Celebrity Dungeons and Dragons. And we were working on negotiating all the things. And then RJ said, oh, yeah, you know who plays Dungeons and Dragons? It's Q from Bond. What's her name now? Judy Dench, yeah. Dame Judy. She plays Dungeons and Dragons. That's crazy. I flew to London. I meet my friends to go, do you know Judy? Not only do we know Judy Dench, we know her daughter's boyfriend. Why don't we invite him over to the pub and you can ask that question? Okay, hey, does Judy Dench play Dungeons & Dragons? No way. She can't even do charades. She would never play Dungeons & Dragons. Like, what the hell? And like, we had like flown, like, this was a major part of our selling point. And then we come back and ask, hey, where did you find this information? And it was in the foreword of a Dungeons & Dragons playbook that this guy just made up. He was some reporter, just made up. Oh yeah, Judy Dench plays Dungeons & Dragons. And then that somehow spread through this con that made me fly to London, that a whole... similar story to Stalin and the thing to be sensational. No offense, RJ. I you are forgiven. After all these years, it was a lovely bar trip. I'll send you the bill. Nah, I'm kidding. It was awesome. What else happened in the last 2 years? Yes, your question.
I have a question. Have you looked into the Atlanta Stonehenge?
The Atlanta Stonehenge. Is that piece of granite that, yes, that is paid for by some anonymous millionaire?
Well, the mysterious person that...
Yes, the mysterious person. We have not seen this, but we know about it, and we've talked about it in our documentary. And in it, there's an engraving or an inscription on there, or some saying...
There's a whole bunch of series of inscriptions saying how humanity can save themselves.
Like how humanity can save themselves, and that population will be... dwindled down to 500,000, and that somebody spent big money on this.
Yes.
It's an
Eaton.
And what?
It's an Eaton.
It's an Eaton. I thought you said, and it can be eaten. No. Well, that's really... that is not foresight on an investment. But I made a granite sculpture that can be eaten. Georgia. It is in Eaton.
Georgia, yeah.
Eaton, Georgia. And that's how far from here?
About 2.5 hours.
2.5 hours, right. And we talked to Dr. Stanley Monteith in our documentary. And he sort of, he's got a five-hour daily radio show that he talks about all of these sort of things. He was a doctor in San Francisco and now is all about basically the our food supply being genetically altered. And he has all of these medical statistics. And he sort of supports that idea that there is some sort of conspiracy by ConAgra, Monsanto, and all of these things to actually eliminate the population because we're taking their resources and stuff like that. So it's quite fascinating. And it's hard to, I mean, the level of statistics and facts that he has at his disposal made it very hard for me to do any sort of rebuttal whatsoever. So it was, it's a shocking part of the documentary for sure. And you can see that Sunday at 7, in case you forgot. Latecomers, Sunday at 7, a screening of our documentary over at the International South Ballroom at the Hyatt, Sunday at 7, with a Q&A to follow with both me and the director, Phil Larness, who's on the camera over there.
I got one. Mm.
Yes, you had it right here.
The X-Files reruns that they're talking about doing, you were talking on Facebook about...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The new thing I'm working on. Yes. That's right. There's a new network that I'm helping launch that is called U2 TV. And it's like U as in you and 2 as in also. And it's this new interactive network. And they have a program on their website or an app you can actually download to your smartphone or tablet. And you can actually record 15 seconds of video, submit it, and it immediately appears on TV in the same episode that we're actually talking about. So they're going to show reruns of The X-Files. I'm hosting it. And then based on that episode of The X-Files, we give you what they call fame spots, fame spot topics. So if it's all about UFOs, then we ask you, have you ever seen a UFO? Tell us all about it in a 15-second video. You tell us about it. You send it in. And then they have some sort of quick screener to make sure you're not naked. And then it's immediately, you're on the same episode as the thing. So then it becomes this whole interactive thing. And then we're all tweeting at the same time, and it'll be hilarious. And so this is a new network. Rob Burnett, who does all the reality shows like Survivor and Apprentice, he's the guy behind this whole thing. and he's got a couple other networks, and this thing starts, I believe, September 24th it will begin its rollout, and then it rolls out from there. So it'll be this interactive TV show, and they're not just doing X-Files, they're doing 1960s Batman, they're doing the Justice, some not celebrity, what the hell is the name of that? True Justice? There's like some 70s cowboy justice show that they found. It's like this hilarious cult classic. I can't even remember the hell the name of it is. And then they got other episodes as well of other shows. So it'll be all this sort of thing where you get basically to be on TV. So instantly, no matter what you want, you just film yourself and then you're on TV within a matter of minutes. You call your mom, say you're a TV star. There you go. That's how they roll. So it'll be really fun. I'm hosting it. And then in between the commercials and stuff, I have behind the scenes stories and hilarious things. Much like I'm chatting now, only I'm dressed nicer. Yeah. So that's coming out. That's U2 TV. And then I think they have their own Facebook page and everything. So, but I don't think of that the video recorder is operational yet. U2.com. That's, you can go there. I should remember this because I've been saying it for 2.5 weeks into a teleprompter. U2.com. Go to U2 TV where U2 can be on TV. U2 TV where U and TV is together. U2 TV. And U2.com where you can record your fame spotter with our fame spot recorder. At U2 TV where U2 can be on TV. And we'll be right back after this at U2 TV with you and TV. That's pretty much all I said. Yeah, thank you. Hey, it's in my brain. It's forever in my brain. Yes. I'm going to the art opening tonight. The fan, isn't it fan art opening at 8:30 tonight? Is that? Am I the only one going to be there? Okay, great. I'll tell you all about it. What picture show?
Buffy Horror.
Oh, Buffy Horror Picture Show. Yeah, yeah, right. I should see that if I'm doing a Buffy comedy improv tomorrow.
I can hook you up with a spike that's in the horror picture.
You can hook me up with a spike. Listen, a lot of things have happened at DragonCon, but I'll tell you what's not happening. Me hooking up with a spike. That is not... I don't know how many rumors you want to start. Oh, some pointers on how to play Spike. Oh, that would be good. Yes,
yeah, you're the one who read innuendo in it.
I did read innuendo. I'm sorry. I don't know why I did that.
Where my?
It's because it's Dragon Con. I read innuendo just to be on the safe side. That's right. Oh, so there's an actual Spike portrayer.
Yeah,
there.
It's live.
It's live. Is it? Are they doing the musical? That musical one they do every year, right?
Yes.
And it's a complete replica of the musical episode of Buffy.
Right.
Yes. Fantastic.
Great.
I might not be there, but. I'm glad somebody's going. Yeah, your question.
How did you come to host? I saw you hosting a like a Ghost Hunters TV show.
Oh, the Ghost Hunters. Ghost Adventures Live. 7 hours of hell. That's right. Halloween night. Did anybody see that on the Travel Channel a couple years ago? One other person. Yeah, five of us. Zach, Nick, and Aaron are the Ghost Adventurers. They go out and fight, not fight ghosts. They're kind of a young, buff men who then go and yell at ghosts in haunted places. Just going, hey, ghosts, we're taking over. Damn you. And there's nobody there. It's just like, hey, you ghosts better come out and show yourself because we're kicking ass. And like, I've been to a lot of seances. I don't remember that ever being an effective way of communicating with the dead. But that's what they do. They go in and they kick ass. So we went to the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in Weston, West Virginia.
Woo!
What? Yes. One other person. Are you from West Virginia? Anywhere near Weston?
Not too far.
Not too far. So you've been, you know the a lunatic asylum I'm talking about. Originally it was a Civil War prison, and then they kept adding on, and it was a functional lunatic asylum right until the 80s, and it's gothic and horrible and run down and rusty, and apparently very haunted. Except when you move in 6 satellite trucks that just irradiate the whole place with microwaves, and even the caretaker goes, boy, man, I've been here 17 years. This is the quietest I've ever seen this place. It's like, because they had all these live trucks. They wanted to do it live. So instead of just bringing, like, one live news van because there's only 6 cameras, they brought in everything from Indy 500. Basically, it was like 6 semi-trailers of satellites and stuff, and there was just so much energy coursing that absolutely nothing happened. All night long, not a single thing. A bat flew in the studio. That was it. And then the rest of the time, they're just walking. And so, to answer your question, how I got involved, is every Christmas I do an improv comedy show at the Queen Mary, where they do a ghost hunt in Long Beach down through the haunted bowels of the Queen Elizabeth II, or Queen Elizabeth I.
The Queen Mary.
No, it's the Queen Mary. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's not the Queen Elizabeth.
Which is why they decided to name it.
That's why they named it the Queen Mary. That's right. Yes, the Queen Mary that's docked in Long Beach, and it's very haunted. And so I've been on ghost hunts with these guys, and or not those guys, but other ghost hunters. And Dave Schrader, who has a radio show called Darkness Radio, had heard about my comedy show and brought me in. And so that's how I got to meet these guys. And they said, hey, you're lots of fun. Why don't you come host this thing all night long? Which my specialty is improv comedy. Improv means you don't read from a teleprompter till 3 o'clock in the morning when you're it's just like that. So I'm hosting this thing, and nothing's going on. And so the second hour, they go to the second floor, and they bring a guy in who has the amazing ghost-capturing machine. It's a remote-controlled 6-foot plexiglass box with a giant Tesla coil on the inside that sparks, and then it can release smoke because ghosts need energy to transform themselves into a 3-dimensional world. So they're going to be attracted to this giant Tesla coil that's shooting out 3 million volts of electricity. And then once they're in the plexiglass box, you slam the door and you hit the smoke machine, and then you're supposed to see a ghost running around on live television. So this was going to happen. So this thing starts, the remote control starts, it goes 12 feet, and the engine dies. Just sits at the beginning of the hallway, just sparking away. And then Zach, Nick, and Aaron, who are supposed to be these tough guys, are so scared of the bloody sparky thing that they're pressing themselves up against the wall to try to get around the Tesla coil, which totally then annihilates, oh, tough guys, are you? Yeah, the scary Tesla coil that doesn't even shock you is scaring you out of your own ghost hunting adventure. So then, okay, so they got these little handicams that are, infrared night vision things, and they have to walk around, but the walls are so thick they can't use their wireless transmitter, so they have to plug in these cables. So they can only go so far up and down the thing live as they're looking for bloody ghosts or whatever, corpse they can find. So the guy with the who invented this ghost capturing machine then decides to go the opposite direction from Zach, Nick, and Aaron with his K2 meter. For those who don't know, a K2 meter is a way of determining whether a ghost is there, because you have electromagnetic energy that will then show up as a light bar, and then you know a ghost is in the area. So he's walking the opposite end down the hallway, and nothing's happening, and then he just sort of throws the damn thing. And he just goes, oh, a ghost just hit the K2 meter out of my head. What he didn't realize is not because those guys had the cameras, there was also another camera hard-mounted to the ceiling that was following him. And so he was on live TV when he chucked it, and then all the other guys come running and go, what happened, oh my God, yeah, no, a thing hit it out of my hand. And everybody else just went online going, this is bullshit. This is the stupidest thing. That guy threw it. And then they went, and the producers went freaked out, and they went going online, and they replayed that bit over and over. You could go online and watch different camera feeds live, and everybody's going, oh, that guy tossed it. And then Dave Schrader's going, oh, did he throw it or did he get it hit out of his hand? You decide. You tell us. Everybody's going, this is more bullshit. This is now red alert. So now that happened about midnight, 1 o'clock, okay? So by 3 a.m., and now you got to realize, I did a camera rehearsal. I got there 10 a.m. I did like a camera blocking rehearsal right till 6, and then I basically had 30 minutes to put on a suit and then go live at 7 and have something to eat. They didn't even break for lunch. So by 1 o'clock, I'm delirious, my eyes are blurry, I can't read the teleprompter anymore, I have no idea what's going on. So I'm thinking, okay, it's over, it's 3 a.m., they've gone through the hospital ward there where they've lied in a morgue, they've done all sorts of weird things, and they're going to come out, and I'm supposed to wrap it up going, well, we all had an exciting evening, and boy, that's been great, and thank you, Western West Virginia. And then as I'm saying that, Zach's, Zach goes, Dean, hang on a sec. And he goes over, crosses the grass. The camera has to follow him. Goes to the guy who had the ghost hunting machine. Goes, hey, did you throw that K2 meter or what? Like, it's 3 a.m. We're getting into this fight on live television. He goes, no, man, that really hit that. This is, you better not, because our reputation's on the line. It's like, oh, my God, it's a complete meltdown at 3 a.m. on the Travel Channel. Anyway, join us next time when I won't be here. That's not going to happen. Yeah, that was a traumatizing experience, to be sure. But the guys are great, and the guy with the ghost machine said he was going to sue for defamation of character, which I didn't know you could do that. Hey, that was really a ghost. No, it wasn't. I'm suing you. Really? We're going to take that to court? How's that going to work? And then Zach, Nick, and Aaron went on to invite me back next Christmas at the Queen Mary, and we had a great time. And they're great guys, and the show is still a hit. But that that Halloween was one I'll never forget. In West Virginia.
Do you have a favorite Lone Gunman episode that you? A
favorite Lone Gunman episode. You know, my favorite still is the origin episode that was on the X-Files in season 5, The Unusual Suspects, because that one was like, that was so fun, because we had no idea. Like, the writers even remembered us, frankly. It was like, oh, I think we got our own episode. And it was this weird thing because I think David had just done that movie where he's in the Speedo and he's the doctor for the gang thing. What's that called? Playing God, that's right. I just have a burnt image of him in the Speedo. That's all I can think about. What's the movie with him in the Speedo? Playing God. Really? Yeah, I guess so. So he had to do reshoots for that. In the middle of the season, at the same time, Jillian was booked over doing a promotional thing in Europe. So suddenly, everybody went, oh my God, how are we going to work around this? There's nothing we can do. Oh, I know. Let's just put the Lone Gunman in their own episode. And so they went, oh yeah, that'd be fun. And then it was like an origin episode where it was actually backdated to 1989, and it's how we all met at a convention, and then I'm playing Dungeons and Dragons for money. That was fun, and I'm Lord Manhammer. Thank you very much. That is excellent. That is a prize right there. Did you all know Lord Manhammer is the name of the... And in fact, somebody emailed me going, dude, do you play Dungeons and Dragons? I go, well, I've played a couple games. Do you use Lord Manhammer as your name? As your character? No, I do not. Can I? Yes, you can. You are now the official Lord Manhattan. Awesome! Oh, that's awesome. So there's somebody out there with the actual character Lord Manhattan. I believe is an elf that can spit water, but still, it's a good name. But yeah, that was so much fun, and that was also, you know, up till then you sort of get like a crummy trailer. This we got like a big double wide that then Tom brought like his video game, and we all like hung out and watched movies. It was like being in a dorm with a gunman. It was just like, this is totally awesome. And then, we got to like, shoot for weeks. And then David came in at the end and did a couple of days. And then it was like, it's such a cool episode. So it was really fun to do. And then they killed us off. Sixth season. What's that? Right. Technically, we may not be dead. That's right. I like to tell at a convention, everybody goes, oh, too bad you died. And I go, well, you know, officially, when you have a hermetically sealed steel coffin to contain a virus from the CDC, it has to be actually fitted to the size of the person. And if you look at that funeral scene, all three of those steel coffins are all the same size, even though one gunman is shorter than the other two. Therefore, our bodies may not be in the coffin. And in fact, that's a thing, because the art department actually made a shorter coffin, and then they said, no, make all three the same, that'll be our safety in case we need the gunman to be alive for some reason.
X-Files 3.
X-Files 3, that's right. Yeah. Just the gunman this time. That's right.
It'll be better.
Wow, I didn't say that. You didn't like the second one?
Did not like the second one.
As somebody pointed out, it was a bit misleading in the trailers, because there was like a truck with a light over it, and then there's Billy Connolly with like what looks like oil in his eyes, and then you watch the movie, and it's like, oh, the truck is parked under a light. Yeah. And Billy Colley poked his eye. Wait a sec. There's nothing X-Files about either one of those scenes. That's true. I know, I was kind of disappointed. I thought, you know, at the height of the Bush administration, and you're going to do Russian head transplants? Really? This is your whole X-Files episode? You thought there'd be something a little more conspiratorial than a guy transplanting heads of his head on women, weren't they? I can't even remember how it is. Yeah, one woman. Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert, yeah, by the way. Those who haven't had a chance to catch X-Files 2, Russian head transplants on a woman's body.
4 years ago.
Yeah, you should have seen it by now. That should have been on the note on the door, come see X-Track, spoiler alert. I'm going to ruin every movie you've seen or haven't seen. And, of course, follow me on Twitter, D. Haglin. Hilarious comment once a day. But it's great, everybody. See you all again. Thanks again. We'll see you at the table. I'm D. Haglin. Thank you. Thank you.
That was fun.
Wasn't that fun?
Yeah.
I love doing those panels, by the way.
And, well, you're very good at them. Everybody clearly enjoys themselves. It's fun, actually. Hearing them, you know, I mean, I did obviously shoot the whole panel, but it's interesting getting to then relive it just with the audio,
yes.
You know.
In your head.
In my head.
As you imagine it.
So now for the next half hour
wow.
or so, next 25, 26 minutes or so, yeah. We are going to hear highlights from the post-screening Q&A
right.
that you and I did after the Sunday night screening of The Truth Is Out There.
So we showed The Truth Is Out There on the big screen. Everybody came, and then those at very well, late. It was late.
Well, do you remember this, though?
Yeah.
They actually listed on the schedule our Q&A as a separate event
from
the screening.
Right.
So there was supposedly going to be this break between the screening, the end of the screen, like a half-hour break between the end of the screening and the beginning of the Q&A, which, you know, so, and we talk about this. This is a funny little bit, I think, off the top.
Right.
So why don't we just run it? This is, for the next 25, 26 minutes or so, highlights from our Q&A after The Truth Is Out There. And I did really, I think, a good job of kind of cutting out the questions because the audience wasn't mic'd.
Right.
And, but we did a pretty good job of addressing the questions within our answers.
So imagine you've just seen our documentary. You're in a dark room in Atlanta.
Wearing a costume. Sweating like hell.
That's right.
And 3 days of liquor being sweated out.
And we're up on a stage and on a table at Diaz, as it were, with some microphones in front of us, and it sounds like this.
I think you did mention this, but it said on the schedule that we were doing a Q&A for this movie at 10 p.m.,
yeah.
Even though the movie ended at 9:20. So
so we're not going to talk about the movie for 40
yeah,
minutes.
40 minutes.
And then,
we're just going to stare back at you.
And then 10 o'clock, we'll answer questions. No, we'll answer questions.
No, and then probably more people will come in at 10, and that way they'll at least get some. Although, you know what? And we won't let anyone in on this. On the and then we'll start the Q&A. But on the thing outside, it actually says at 10 p.m. there will be a 0.5 minute Q&A. Right. So this is what we do. Right. At 10 o'clock, when we see if anybody comes in for the 10, are you here for the 10 o'clock Q&A? Okay.
Yeah.
One of you ask a question, and then 30 seconds into our answer, let's just get up and discuss.
We gotta go. That's it. In 0.5 minutes, we are pissed off.
We don't fly from California for more than a 30-second Q&A.
We demand that they put on the schedule 0.5 minutes. That's right.
I love how kind of angry we got towards each other on Twitter last night. We were at the same party, drinking the same booze, and expressing hostility towards each other
right.
over Twitter.
Though we were as polite as hell to each other in our face. Yeah. Like, oh, it's great to see you. You did an excellent job. You're a dick.
We, after all these years together, we do anti-social networking.
That's right. That's right. We are angry, angry people on Twitter.
I mean, I think you see in the film the effect that Dean has on people, and that I think we all have on people when someone is sharing their insights with you, and they feel like you really are listening to them and see them, And it's amazing then how much they open up and how personable and funny and self-deprecating. You know, they may take, obviously, their information or what they do seriously, but they're not taking themselves seriously because they realize they don't have to prove anything to you. And they don't... And so these conversations would go in many, many different directions, obviously. And sometimes we would have to, you know, it's like, Dean, it's been 4 hours. I'm out. We're shot out and we haven't hit our questions yet. So yeah. Maybe we could. So there was that. But in terms of not believing, you know, this was a really important question for me looking through the camera, because I didn't prep at all what these people were going to say or bring to the table, because I wanted to be making a movie about people, not about information. I wanted to be capturing them. And so I didn't want to have anything in my mind of, okay, this is what they're about, this is who they are, this is their viewpoint, and start deciding shots in advance and things like this. And what I found was belief is very easy. You know, I think belief is just... is something we should give each other as courtesy and respect. I don't have to live my life by what you're saying. Why should I be scared to believe you, just to offer you the belief? And then we get out of even the realm of belief and get into the things that you know. And those are the things by which you live your life. And that's fascinating to me. And that's where most of these conversations led. And I think, you know, what happened was you saw Dean speaking with authentic people. And so does that mean we agree with them? Or not always, of course. But when someone's authentic, why not believe them?
Yeah. And that was sort of the thing. I mean, you know, often after a screening, somebody goes, so what do you believe? Like, they have to nail it down. Like, even a reviewer said, certainly not everyone in that documentary can be is believable. You know, so somewhere you have to make a draw a line in the sand between those people are unbelievable and those are believable. And as we said, you know, all of them have good information, whether or not you believe in what they say.
I think the question gets back to... It's a great question. Thank you for asking. I think it gets back to a conversation Dean and I have on and off, and he actually credits me with the phrase, although I
don't remember
it. Yeah, it's too brilliant. But it's something that Dean brought up one time, that it's different for something to be valid as to have value. Having value and having validity are not the same thing. Within a validity is defined by the construct of the conversation you are having. If I'm trying to figure out how to fix my car, you trying to teach me how to drive the car is not valid to that conversation. It doesn't mean, however, that what you're saying doesn't have value. After all, one day I'm going
to
get that damn car fixed.
Right.
But I feel like, again, one of the things that makes modern life so tough, and we're inundated with all this information, that we, as self-preservation instinct, kind of throw up our arms and try to say, okay, well, that's not valid. I can cut that out. I can stop listening to that person because what they're saying is not valid.
Even though it might have value.
Later on.
Right.
And indeed, isn't that where we're at? We've got a whole lot of people who don't know how to drive the car.
Right. We're going in circles. Yeah. So
I think that's it. It wasn't that ever we were leading anywhere that I don't think had value. It just might not have been valid for the purposes. And you know, that promise at the end that we're going to have Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mysteries, that was kind of born out of this. So many of these narratives do tend towards a long view of history. We let ourselves dip our toes into that longer view. But of course, if we'd really gone there, this would have been, twice the length.
Right.
So the next film, we thought it would be interesting, will kind of shift the perspective, and it'll be 10% contemporary and 90% longer view of history.
Luckily, the producers and Phil kept me somewhat in the dark about what these guys spoke of, so that as we had a conversation, I would discover in the moment on camera what they believed and what I also knew. So I brought also my own, wealth of knowledge. Do I have a wealth of knowledge of these sort of things? My bucket of knowledge that I have to these conspiracies.
and put that out there as they spoke. So there wasn't, I mean, everybody I talked to was mind-blowing and eye-opening. And so all of it was completely fascinating. It was a really fascinating year and a great, great experiment on traveling the world, for sure. But was there anybody that really blew your mind, Phil, or changed your mind?
Well, not changed my mind, because this movie couldn't ultimately be, you know, what do you do with all this footage? I mean, you know, yeah. It's really hard. I've never seen a movie like this. I've never seen a film structured like this, with kind of the spherical structure that requires the audience to draw the connections between things. No two people saw the same movie tonight at all, I guarantee you. And I've now seen it many times, and I get something new out of it every time, because you do have the freedom to make connections between things. I would say that what I wanted to avoid, the mistake, the trap that I could have very easily gotten into, because it is, oh, by the way, the job of the guy editing the movie, is also a trap. And that is something that we see every single person do, which is the human need to try to connect all the dots. To try to say, okay, this is the picture. As if any one of us can do that, right? Because we all have unique perspectives for a reason. And what started to really scintillate and come to life in this film was, oh, my job is not to connect dots. My job is to honor all of these voices and to take my cues from all those voices, much like we could all do, right, which is go and take your unique excellence and your unique excellence and your unique excellence and start to build something beautiful. And that, I realized, was my job, not so much weighing information or value systems, even really getting to the themes they were expressing and learning how to tell a story. And they were all telling me how to tell this story.
Right, which is why I like Dragon Con, that message of our strength is in our diversity. If you ever want to see diversity, you come to Dragon Con, and you see diversity, and then you realize our strength. And it's like totally awesome. It's a celebration of strength and diversity in a very colorful way.
But only if the Goblin King tells you it is.
Damn that Goblin King, where is he? Is there a truth? Yeah. Well, I think Dr. Tiller said it best, is that the truth is that there may be, all truth may be subjective. That's the most mind-blowing thing, that there is no universal out there truth, that all truth is subjective to each and every one of us. And again, that brings us back to our diversity, and that our strength is that if each one of us has a subjective truth, that then as a diversity of viewpoints and truths, then our strength then becomes one whole piece. And it sounds pretty all...
Well, I think I would just add to that, that this idea, obviously, that we're projecting our truth out into the world is mirrored by the fact that the world is mirroring back to us truths about ourselves all the time, every minute of every day.
Right.
What was so much fun when we had finished making the film and had seen it with an audience and felt good about the fact that we've made something that can move people, can inspire people, can anger people, it can make its own friends, and people can have their own conversation with the film. Because that's what we wanted. I mean, people have a hard time sometimes. What was your desire in doing this? Well, we wanted to inspire conversation. We wanted to try to cut through so many people yelling and arguing and fighting and just start talking and getting to know people and getting to know different truths. And because that's fun. That's what we have been doing for years on our show, and that's why we travel around and doing this. The one moment that we had that was hysterical, though, was on the show. I reminded that our motivation was to answer the question, what does it mean to search for the truth in a world where conspiracies or conspiracy theories are everywhere? And at the same moment that Dean was saying, and we never got an answer to that question, I was saying, and we clearly got an answer to that question.
I was like, what?
And the answer to me was him.
Right.
That he embodies what it means to do that, the way that he walks through the world saying yes. And the same. Did any of you see, either this time or in the past, his improv show here at Dragon Con? I mean, this is the training that he brings to bear every show that he does, which is, again, the idea of validity versus value in the game that he's playing right then when he's asking for suggestions, because he writes nothing in advance, prepares nothing. Mm-hmm. He has to listen to everything. He has to be open. He makes choices, of course, based on what is valid to the construct that's going on stage, but he's remembering everything. Because, oh, man, the gold that is out there coming at him all the time.
Comedy gold.
And if he ever started to shut down or say no, the show wouldn't be funny. The right. show wouldn't be...
Kind of not funny at all.
So
that's interesting, yeah.
But anyway, my question is, what is it that really attracted you to the role of Langley?
What attracted me to the role of Langley? The fact that I didn't have to cut my hair. what was great about it was... Well, it was really interesting, actually, because up to that time, a guy with long hair in Vancouver would basically be playing drug dealers, crack addicts, and homeless people. That was all I was being cast in like, Street Justice with Carl Weathers. You're crack addict number four. It's like, oh, my God. Okay, come in for your audition. I actually had my own crack outfit. It was like a black leather jacket and torn jeans. I wore it to every audition. Just, like, walk in, don't wash your hair, just roll out of bed. Go to the audition. Wow, you really look like a crack addict. Yeah, I know. I don't know why.
So I've seen a couple people this weekend dressed as crack addict number four. It's true.
Crack addict number four.
It's a popular costume this year.
It goes in cycles. Street Justice. Yeah, we could have a Street Justice reunion with Carl Weathers. That'd be awesome. That would be awesome. Anyway, so I'm, then I got a call from my agent. Hey, we want you to audition for the X-Files. What's the X-Files? I don't know. Something with FBI and aliens. I haven't watched it. It's like, okay, great. And they go, so we don't know what they're looking for, but just go in and just read, for some, one of the three parts, there's three guys. So just, they'll tell you what you're going to read for. So there was no way to even, prepare for the audition. And I go in, and it's a room of 40 people, and it's everybody. It's comics that I work with. It's guys in full fatigues that are 6'7", shaved bald. Like, there's, I don't know what the hell they were thinking. They didn't know what the hell they were thinking. And then I go in, and I start reading for Langley, and it's the episode EBE, and I think it's the stupidest audition because half of it, I'm on a phone. If you remember that scene, I'm talking to somebody else while Byers and Frohickey are talking to Mulder. So the two casting agents are having a conversation while I'm just sitting there staring at them in the chair going, I am wasting my time here reading this thing. But then... they call me back four or five times. I read with other people in suits to figure out who's going to be Byers, including Gary Jones, who later became Walter Harriman in Stargate SG-1. And him and I are best of friends, so if we were gunmen, that would have been insane. And then finally they couldn't find Frohickey, and they just cast the first AD. So when we got to the first day of set, it's like, hey, congratulations, Bruce. Hey, I didn't know. Yeah, this is going to be awesome, a day on set. Hey, who did they get to do Frohickey? I heard they got the first AD. Ah, what the hell? This is the stupidest show. Well, they're just casting crew now? This is bullshit. But then he turned out to be a great guy, and then we did that episode. So from there, it was just going to be the one episode, and then they kept bringing us back throughout the season till by season 5 we had our own episode, and then by season 8 we had our spinoff, and the show, it just kept growing. Our roles kept growing. And it was often because of the fan... interaction on the internet that they all said, hey, look at the Lone Gunman, they're just like us. This means that Chris Carter and Frank, they're all lurking on our websites and in our news groups. And in fact, they would steal lines from the news groups for the Lone Gunman to say. So that always helped too. That was always hilarious. So,
well, I've said this before, but I think that there was a really special into the show for the fans through the Gunman, because the Gunman represented something really important, which is that friendships, long-lasting friendships, can be based on something as esoteric and idealistic as the idea of being a truth seeker.
Right.
And that can be the important formation for friendship.
Exactly. And that was the whole thing. I mean, so many people appreciated just the relationship between Mulder and Scully being one based on mutual respect for each other's work, and that there wasn't a love interest or crazy will they or won't they till season 9. But anyway, the point is that up till then, it was fantastic. I'm a clear no Romo for those of you ever wondering that. For you shippers out there, to hell with you!
The scariest thing associated with the episode Triangle, though, and this is not even a joke, involves the power of Chris Carter. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I do.
Okay. Will you share this? No. Well, okay, I'll set it up, right? Dean was on hiatus, told no one that he was going to go to the Midwest to just, you know, play some clubs, do some improv comedy. Checks into a hotel room in the middle of what, Wisconsin?
I was in Arbor.
Ann Arbor, Michigan?
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
So you get into your hotel room.
Yes.
Phone rings. You've told nobody. Phone rings. We've got a call from Chris Carter for you.
Yes. It's like, what? I didn't even know I was staying at this hotel. How did you know? And it's like, hello? Hey, Dean, it's Chris. How are you? It's like, good. I'm just getting ready to do a show in Ann Arbor. Yeah, yeah. Hey, listen, we'd appreciate it if you don't do science fiction conventions. I'm like, what? No, I'm doing stand-up. No, I know you're doing stand-up tonight. But, like, in general, just don't do science fiction conventions.
But I thought that was also the call where he was telling you about Triangle. He was setting you up that they had to fly you back.
Oh, yeah, that they were flying me back.
Because they needed to do this, and he laid out how look, this is really important. You're about to get a script delivered to your room.
Oh, that's right.
And you need to be prepped because we're doing it all in master shots. Master for people shot. Who don't know, the episode was rather extraordinary. Chris Carter set it up and directed it because he wanted to win an Emmy for Best Director. He did not. Right. But it was all done in master shots.
Right, one takes. And they were long,
kind
long,
of like
long
Hitchcock's
takes.
Rope.
Yeah, kind of like Hitchcock's rope.
Oh, it was all one take.
It was all
the whole show was theoretically one take.
Right.
They you know.
But, yeah, they fudged it here and there. But then
commercial breaks.
Yes, but basically they said, look, you should learn all your lines really well because there's not going to be, if we have to do it again, it's going to be a 15-minute take again. So know your damn lines.
So a lot of supposed alien implants may have been put there by producers of television shows.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he has quite... In fact, my other favorite story of then the power of that is when Chris Owen, who played Agent Stiffneck...
Jeffrey Spender.
Jeffrey Spender, yeah. I always called him Stiffneck. I don't know why. Yeah, Agent Spender. He got... He was sitting in an apartment. It was rainy in Los Angeles. And he gets a call from Chris. And it's like, Chris, yeah, hey, Chris. Hey, Chris, ha, ha, ha. Hey, listen, yeah, we're going to kill you off. We're really sorry about that. It's like, oh, no, really? Yeah, but it's going to be really cool. And, you know, really, but you know, no one ever dies in sci-fi. Right? Okay. Yeah, anyway, so, hey, thanks a lot. And it's going to be great next week working with you, blah, blah, blah. Okay, right. Okay, bye. Click. And then as he's sitting there, and by this time now, the sun's gone down, so he hadn't turned on any lights in his apartment, but underneath the doorway, the light from the hallway is coming through, and just as he hangs up the call, 2 feet appear in his doorway, and the script slides under his door with the death scene under there. And then the feet just walk away, just like... Wait, were you listening to the call outside the door? Like, how did you do that?
At that moment, you're relieved suddenly that he actually meant they were killing you off in the show.
I know, because it could have gone the other way.
Yeah, it could have gone so much worse.
We're going to kill you. There's two. Look at your doorway. That's how you're dead, right there. Okay, final question goes to Phil Ernest.
Oh, well, this is your 8th time to Dragon Con.
It is my 8th time. Who's been here 8 times? Oh, 5 of us. Yeah, and the guys who work here. Yeah, I've been here 8 times. Shut up, pal.
Has anybody here ever go to Comic-Con in San Diego? No? No?
No.
Dean, you were saying some things. Obviously, Comic-Con's a big deal. It becomes a bigger and bigger deal within the film industry every year. You were at San Diego Comic-Con this year to help promote the series Femme Fatales, on which you acted.
On Cinemax?
But can you talk a little bit about your affection for Dragon Con and about why it is so refreshingly different from something like, say, Comic-Con?
True, because at Comic-Con, people do dress up in characters and get their pictures taken, much like here. But it's being increasingly more and more drowned out by studio executives and producers coming in with the next TV show, which actually has nothing to do with comic books or sci-fi. I mean, the fact that half the entire floor was taken up by a fake 1960s Pan Am plane where they're handing out tote bags for their series Pan Am. It's like, what? What? What comic book? What do you get out of here with the Pan Am thing? Like, it becomes now this sort of marketing juggernaut where they think, oh my gosh, there's a whole bunch of crazy nerds that are passionate about stuff. We got to get our show in there. Let's shoehorn. Let's screw those guys who actually draw the comics. Stuck them to the wall because we're sticking our Pan Am set right where they used to sit. So hell with you guys who actually create shit. We're putting our show right here. And it's just like, you know, it becomes this more and more blatant three-dimensional commercial that you walk through that just becomes less and less fun. And when you come here, that is refreshingly gone. I mean, this is, again, the strength of our diversity is the fact that we're all here having a great time and that we're, you know, and there's so many individual gaming rooms and live-action role-playing games and different tracks that you can go to, different panels. And all of it, to me, is so fantastic. And so, you know, still on a volunteer basis, so much of it. And it's not become this yet, knock on wood, because the moment Hollywood hears, wait, there's 100,000 people all dressed up like anime, we're getting our anime set here, or whatever the hell that's going to be. So hopefully it will always remain true to the roots of the people, and that's why I love coming here.
There is something special to this event. You know, look, obviously sales go on. By the way, we're selling the DVDs and The Truth is out there. Right. So if there's someone you know who would like the film, feel free to get them one. We would sign it. So there, see, we're selling things. See? And at the same time, though, you know, like somebody asked, well, wait a minute, you're already selling the DVDs, so why are you having free screenings? You know, what kind of business sense does that make? And I say, I don't know, and I have my bodyguard rough them up a little bit. But... But it's because, you know, we're kind of, as much as we bicker like an old married couple,
shut your hole.
We are both driven by the fact that, you know, more important to us than any particular story that we're a part of that ends up on screen, the story that we're telling with our lives is the one that matters the most to us, and we want it to be an interesting, fun story.
Right.
And so if I get an opportunity to come and share this with people, that's what I want to do because I really want to make friends, and what I have to offer is, you know, my storytelling. And so it was very interesting that during the first part of the film, I was stressing out like a nervous parent back there going, God, the seats are uncomfortable. People are going to be sitting in here. You know, it's not the optimum way to see a movie, right? And I'm going, oh, I hope they like it. I hope that this is worthwhile for them. And I'm just going, okay, you know, look, you're here to make friends. So go make friends. So I let you have the movie, and I just wandered out, saw someone who was wearing this really beautiful T-shirt that said, autism, it's not a programming error, it's an operating system. And I said, I want to know about this T-shirt. Will you talk to me? And so we ended up getting involved in this conversation about Asperger's syndrome and autism and ADHD, and more people started overhearing what we were talking about. And so for an hour, I had this incredibly beautiful conversation with people all about a T-shirt. And that's why Dragon Con is special. That's not happening at Comic-Con. It's not happening at other film festivals. It's not happening at other places I go. And that's why I'm grateful to be here. And I'm grateful that all of you are here. So thank you.
There you go. Can we wrap it up?
We can do that in studio.
Okay, awesome. Yeah.
Listen to Chill Pack Hollywood Hour every week, chillpackhollywood.com.
Huh. That was very touching.
Yeah, I thought that was a good way to not only end, of course, the panel, and that was the ending note of the panel, and really kind of, although we were there the next day and, you know, selling the DVDs and signing autographs, it was kind of a nice way to end the whole Dragon Con experience for 2011, and dare I say, a great way to end this installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
You know, what a way to end it.
You know, Dean Haglund, people can find many episodes.
Many of them.
Of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at the official website, chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. They can download them. Jackalope Radio. Of course, you can always write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We read every email, and you often try to answer them on the show.
Which is also fun.
Become a liker of the show on Facebook.
Like us.
Facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Follow us on Twitter.
You are at D. Haglund.
You are full name, Phil Lerness.
Absolutely. And we will be back next week with a brand new show, and we'll hear all about if you still have a voice. Because that's one hell of a long flight.
That's a hell of a
flight. You are literally getting off the plane.
I will be crazy, crazy jet-lagged.
And I may even pick you up, and we may record the show on the drive from the airport so that you... can do it. That might be the way to do it.
That might be the way to do it.
Because otherwise, as soon as you get home, you're going to
I'll put on my jammies and I won't talk to you.
Oh, well then, maybe I will do the show here. Until then, I'm Phil Lernes.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.